Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag.
So no, I don't think I've seen you put your yoga in that
I
position.
I do it once in a while. Mm-hmm. I do. I like it. I can just kind of do this. The only thing is if I like tap it, then it brings up the keyboard.
Right.
Which drives me. I want the keyboard. But yeah. But yeah, I sometimes do. And sometimes I use it like a tablet too, but you never know.
Every now and again, you actually use the touchscreen.
How you doing, Gov?
I'm okay.
So busy. Last week, which wasn't last week, it was a couple weeks ago, we said we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well,
I got sick. What happened to you?
Fire drills.
Yes, exactly.
Always fire drills.
Yeah. But we'll try to be here next week. And we will be here next week.
Yes.
But then we're taking off a couple weeks for the holidays.
I mean, it's
so plan accordingly.
In like a 70-hour week, even sparing an hour is actually a lot of time. Not a lot in terms of percentage.
Yeah.
But holy mackerel,
it adds up.
It adds up.
Yeah, and then you got to do a little bit of prep for the questions and stuff like that. So there's that. All right, first from our buddy Robbie from the last show. He said, you asked about our favorite Excel program. Here's mine. In the late 90s, we were doing experiments on simulating the space environment in a vacuum chamber. Very cool. I built a VBA program in Excel that used an RS-232 port DLL to talk to a
serial. For those that don't know,
okay.
RS-232.
To talk to a mass spectrometer and other equipment, with a single button in Excel, it would start the test, collect the data, analyze the data, do peak detection, and plot out the results. In the late 90s, this used to save us a lot of time and money. Excel and the whole office environment is truly amazing. What's sad is that most people don't even know what VBA is or that it's in office.
The reason stuff like that works is that serial driver just takes, you know, data, text stream, and probably in this case just a string of numerals, mm-hmm. you know, coming from a mass spec. And it would simply read that into a buffer and then manipulate the data to put it into rows and cells and then run a graph on that or run a chart on that.
If that's what you like doing with your mass spec.
I tend to like doing that through my mass spec,
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting that he was doing that so early on, because most of the time back then you would have to have, you know, custom machinery, custom software. You have to pay through the nose in order to get that actually working. So, you know, kudos to him for doing that. It'd be interesting to see if it was still running anywhere.
So do you use anything with a COM port still?
Oof.
I do, which is why I ask.
So I gave up my last kernel debugger, which I used to run with this Comtrol 8-port, 8-serial port connection, where I do all my kernel debugging with actual serial ports.
Yeah, yeah.
Solid, absolutely rock-solid debugging. It always worked. Unfortunately, it was slow.
Yeah.
115-200 baud rate. Trying to write out a dump file, you know, as systems became, you know, more and more memory, mm-hmm. You'd be writing out multi-gigabyte memory dumps, and you just, you know, start a dump and then go away for the weekend, and then, you know, the dump might be done by the time Monday came around. But yeah, all my machines now for kernel debugging is either network kernel debugging or FireWire or USB. But I haven't done serial kernel debugging in a while. None of my machines support it anymore.
Yeah. So I still use a COM port for a Wacom tablet. I like the ArtPad Z.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the right size. It's 4x5 inches,
mm-hmm.
which everyone, you know, you see people use these huge Wacom tablets. Why? I mean, you can always zoom in if you want to get granular on what you're working in.
Mm-hmm.
And having something that small is a lot more efficient. You can move around the screen a lot easier when it's small. So I like the size of the ArtPad Z. And I also have a Bamboo, which is small like that too. But I like the ArtPad Z one. I like the pens better. And so I still use one of those occasionally.
So you have it hooked up to your desktop, I'm assuming?
Yeah, so it's hooked up to my desktop machine at home. And another thing that I like to use is I have an old Space Orb controller.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's got a big ball on it, and it's a 6-degree axis thing. I would love to use that, and it's got a COM port on it. I doubt it would work. But I saw where Scott Hanselman posted a thing on how to take I think it was like an Arduino board or something, and hook it up so that you can use a Space Orb controller mm-hmm. in modern games. And so I'm thinking Oculus Rift with a Space Orb controller would be about the best thing ever.
Interesting. So, have you tried just getting a serial to USB conversion?
I haven't, because I don't know what driver would I install with it.
It probably will actually just work with the default GamePort driver.
I'll try it. I'll try anything.
I mean, it sounds like it was really just a basic joystick more than anything else, mm-hmm. right?
And it worked like one. I don't know if it looked like one to the system, but
it might be using D input. Depending on how old is it? Is it 2000s or like pre-2000s?
Oh, it's probably pre. I mean, it's got a COM port connector.
Well,
so.
I mean, I had COM port stuff in 2003, 2004, yeah. So you can't.
Well, I'll look at the Hanselman post. I'll put the Hanselman post on here too, but I'm sure he talks about how it worked back then.
You might luck out.
Yeah. But either way, I'd like to try it out.
Here's a thought. For those folks that are personally using, what is the oldest piece of equipment or oldest setup
yeah.
that folks are using at home? Like, I don't mean, you know, some industrial thing that
I got something that I could turn it on if I wanted to.
Right.
What are you still using?
What are you actively using? I think my last oldest piece of technology that I was using was an old 486 laptop.
Yeah.
And laptop is a, you know, I'm treating it very nicely here. Mm-hmm. It was a luggable. Battery had long since gone on it, so you had to have it plugged in. And I would run a very simplified version of Linux on it mm-hmm. because what it would do is run IP chains to act as a router because it had a built-in modem that would connect to my Replay TV that would then connect to my wired network because the Replay TV, this is a really old Replay TV. For yeah. those of you that don't know, it was before TiVo. You hook it up and you record your TV shows. It was the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
I loved it. But it would only ever get the guide updates over the phone. You couldn't do anything else to get the guide updates. So I had that hooked up to the built-in modem, had the Replay TV call into it, and then transfer to the internet to actually get the guide listings.
Wow.
It was insane. But, you know, it was this nice little setup that I had shoved in a, whatchamacallit, TV stand.
Yeah, entertainment center is what we like to call them.
Yeah, there you go, entertainment center. I had that running up until 2008, and it was, you know, long since deprecated. Back in 2005, 2004, something like that. But the internet service for the guide listings was still up. And then eventually I just said, you know, I don't need this thing sucking my power anymore.
Yeah.
Just a power hog.
Yeah.
And then finally got rid of it.
So my oldest would be, I just retired my Sound Blaster Odyssey that I used. It had to have been at least 15 years. I think it was closer to 20 though. Mm-hmm. But it was a card that had a breakout box. And the reason I love this thing is it had this breakout box. It was right there on my desk. So I had FireWire, which I don't use anymore. I didn't need it. Mm-hmm. Had MIDI, which was kind of nice. I don't know, a couple like RCA jacks and headphone jack and stuff like that. But it was right there on my desk and I love that. So I had that thing and I just used it forever. And last time I did my computer upgrade, I was like, wow, I really need this. And I really didn't. And a lot of the stuff, like, I don't think the FireWire worked on it. And I know the MIDI didn't work on it. And it was getting very difficult to get drivers, although it just worked out of the box. So, I retired that one. And then the other really old thing that I'm using is I have a old motion computing M1200 tablet PC. Mm-hmm. My daughter started using it because she loves painting and Art Rage. And I was like, why are you using that dinosaur tablet PC? I got a Surface Pro. And she's like, that's got touch. I don't like the touch. I just want to do the pen. Yeah. And I was like, well, I can turn touch off. And I'll just use this. So, there you go.
I just forgot about my actual oldest piece of technology that I'm currently actively using in my house. An HP LaserJet 4 printer.
Oh man, yeah.
From 1992.
Yeah.
Still working, network connected, and you'll love this. parallel to USB adapter that plugs into my Asus router.
Wow.
So it's fully networked. Any machine can get to it. I can print from my Surface RT.
Nice, nice.
To an HP LaserJet 4 printer. 600 DPI, just beautiful. I got a new toner cartridge from a flea market in 2008. I mean, I should be good for another 50,000 pages on that thing.
Yeah, nice. All right, let's see, from Rod, I'm trying to get a light switch application I wrote on my laptop to install into IIS on my desktop in my home network. Both machines are Windows 8.1 Pro machines. Every time I try running the web platform installer 5.0 on my desktop, I get the following error message. There's an error loading custom feed. It's got a URL, error product ID, PHP not found. I'm stumped on what to do with this, especially since I'm running the .msi for my presume is a Microsoft website.
I actually did try to research this problem, and I haven't found any bugs on that. So if you could send the LightSwitch app that you're using, that would be ideal in order to figure out what's going on and see if I can reproduce it.
Cool. Okay. Next question. How can I know my computer running Windows 7 was last restarted? I prefer a solution that doesn't involve searching the event log, but something like WMIC or maybe commands.
Here we go. WMIC OS get last boot up time. And it tells you exactly when it was last booted. And this is correct. So 2014, 1209, 1150, which is about right.
Okay. Nice. There you have it. Boom. All right. Next question. I'm wondering how I can connect two different networks simultaneously, one Wi-Fi and one by Ethernet cable. I have a notebook with built-in wireless adapter and also an Ethernet adapter. After I plug in the Ethernet cable, my Wi-Fi is automatically disabled and shut down. I tried to look to both adapter properties, but none of them have any options saying to disable the other connection.
Okay. This is an interesting question because I'm trying to wrap my brain around what you're trying to do. Once you plug in, so generally speaking, you can't have your two connections working simultaneously. And the only reason I can think of why you might want to do this is to somehow take advantage of the double, quote unquote, double bandwidth.
Throughput.
But you're not actually ever going to get that because presumably your Wi-Fi connection is connected to your router and that's what you're connected to wired as well. So in the end, you're getting to the exact same point, which is your router to the internet.
Yeah.
So you're not going to get any kind of, you know, what we'd like to call channel bonding. And your Wi-Fi speed is generally going to be significantly slower than your wired speed. Now, talking specifically about what your machine is doing, it's likely at the BIOS level, or EFI, depending on if you have BIOS or EFI, your machine is detecting the link connection from wired and is just setting the signal, hey, he's wired, why would you want to use wireless? So it's just disabling wireless. You might also have group policies set where if you're in an enterprise, they may not want what's called bridging, which would be if you're connected to a separate wireless access point and then you're connected to the corporate network, you wouldn't want that to be your machine to be a conduit from a rogue wireless access point into the corporate network or vice versa. So it'd really help to understand what the intent is of trying to have both wireless and wired on at the same time. You know, if you can send more details, then we can actually figure out what you're trying to accomplish and how to accomplish it.
Cool. Okay, from Felipe, he says, I really like your show. Well, we really like you. So he says, because you always know the answers, I was wondering if you could give me some insight regarding removable USB media. Why doesn't Windows allow to create multiple partitions on memory sticks, but only on fixed drives? Every other operating system I know allows you to create multiple partitions on a memory stick. Shouldn't Windows behavior be changed to meet today's needs?
This is more of a standards problem.
Yeah. I didn't even know that that was a thing until I tried it. I didn't know you couldn't create partitions on a thumb drive because I've never tried it before. Until now, thumb drives have been fairly small and I wouldn't need multiple partitions on it, and I don't like lots of drive letters anyway.
Right. Some of the USB sticks have a firmware bit that you can set how it reports itself to the operating system, and you can flip it and say whether it reports as fixed or whether it reports as removable. But ultimately, it's all part of the USB spec, USB mass storage spec.
So what about Windows to Go thumb drives?
Windows to Go thumb drives are different because they will report as fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a different chip. They go through a different set of tests to say that, hey, we can run in this particular mode.
Yeah.
There's certain reliability aspects of reporting as fixed versus removable. When you're fixed, you know, you're not pulling it out. You're not running the safely removed hardware. You're not expecting to be booted from it unless you're running Windows to Go.
Yeah.
And in the case of running Windows to Go, you're not actually able to disable the removable aspect. You know, you can't eject the drive. So really, we can't change the fact that other folks have just disregarded the spec and saying, you know, you can create a partition on the drive. Okay. I mean, I don't really know what to tell you other than if the spec changes, then we can change along with it. But we have compliance reasons that we have to stick with the spec.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Next question. Finding patches and fixes on Microsoft's site is like searching for a needle in a haystack. Is there a trick or a way to find fixes or patches for Windows problems on the Microsoft site? Usually I go to Microsoft support forum site and weed through a lot of comments on the subject.
So there's basically two types of fixes, right? There's the hot fixes, and then there's the fixes that everybody gets on Patch Tuesday. Those, what we call GDR releases, general distribution releases. The reason why you don't necessarily have to go look for fixes is because you just get them automatically. If your machine is meeting the criteria of needing a fix, then we'll go get it. Now, what we generally don't want folks to do is put their machine into the hotfix train, because what that'll do is whenever binary is updated, it gets produced for both the hotfix train and the GDR train. Now, the GDR train tends to be a lot more bake time, a lot more testing goes into it, and there are fewer fixes in a binary that was produced for GDR versus the binaries that are produced for hotfixes. And hotfixes, when someone requests through Microsoft support, hey, we got a problem, blah, 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 they go through it and they say, hey, we'll produce a fix for you, for, you know, particular enterprise customer or whoever paid for the fix, and we'll release it in whatever the binary is. Now, the thing is that when you pick it up from a hotfix, you're also getting all of the other hotfixes that everybody else requested for that particular binary. That means that there are fixes that weren't necessarily fully tested together. There's a lot more fixes that happen in a hotfix than there are in a GDR. So if you compare the two binaries, an LDR fix or a hotfix binary is going to be different from the exact same binary built from the GDR sources. And we don't want generally a lot of people on the hotfix sources, because it just means that there could be more problems, which is why it's a lot harder to get the hotfixes, as you've noticed. What we really want to do is have you go through the support process to request the hotfix so that we can validate that, yes, in fact, you do need that hotfix. Otherwise, it can introduce more problems than it's worth. So it's not the mentality of, hey, let me just go get all of the fixes that I possibly can for my machine and install it, is not actually the right one.
Yeah.
What you want to have is the most stable machine possible, the least amount of updates and changes possible, so that what you're running is something that we've tested and that we've validated. And the reason why we like that is because the more people that are running the exact same thing, the better it is for us to say, yep, you know, you're stable. And we can validate the fact that you're stable because everybody else is stable as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's not you had this one hotfix installed and it in conjunction with another hotfix, it was never tested together.
Yeah.
Right? And then trying to figure out that, it was that kind of problem is very difficult from a support perspective and from our perspective too.
Okay. Next question from Yerel Nezrel, the most annoying viewer that sends you questions all day and all night, which sounds backwards. Anyway, Yerel says, lately every time I boot my PC, I've got a message that says the last USB device you connected did not work. Please retry, or something to that effect. I've got 20 some odd USB things plugged up to this machine. How can I easily tell which device it's talking about?
You can check the event log, the setup API log, but ideally what you probably want to do is figure out how is everything actually connected to your system?
Like,
how many hubs are connected to the system?
And I happen to know this person's home setup intimately, so.
Well, this thought process can actually be for anybody, right? So what you want to have is the minimum number of hubs. You don't want to chain hubs. What you would ideally like to do is have powered hubs, because one of the things, and I'm highly suspecting this, is that during startup, you're getting too much of a power draw.
Yeah.
And one of your devices is just not responding in the right amount of time. So unless all your hubs are powered.
And I think there is one hanging non-powered.
Non-powered.
But things were working before.
Before what?
This person could boot up before and not get that message. And so it's just kind of started lately. And
but every single time?
I don't
time.
Always get it. Not every time I turn they turn the computer on. But sometimes it'll say that. And so, yeah, if I had to guess, I would think it would be one of the things that's plugged into the unpowered USB hub that's hanging off
the back
of that
machine. Have you plugged in anything else new in your room? That is.
Oh yeah, there's always something new getting plugged in, so it might be drawing more power.
Exactly.
Causing.
So you might just have power fluctuations.
Yeah.
So my advice would be look at how many ports there are on the back of the machine, how many USB.
Yeah.
Pick a couple, and from directly in the back of the machine, take two or three hubs, powered hubs. Use those.
Okay.
Connect your keyboard directly to the machine.
Yeah.
Because what you don't want to have is, catastrophic failure during startup or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about hubs at all. So, you know, mouse and keyboard directly into the machine. Anything else, there you can get some nice anchor USB 3 powered hubs where you have individual switches on each port, which is really handy. You can just keep things powered off most of the time if you're never actually using it, and then turn on when you need it. I'd highly suggest those.
Okay. I know this user has two USB 3 cards that are in there just to give more, and this user does not trust those sometimes because they've had failures on those in the past.
I would get rid of those.
Okay. All right.
I'd get rid of the, does this person have native USB 3 on the machine itself?
This person is me, okay, come on, let's just get past that. But does this person have what, native?
Native USB 3, or did?
Oh yeah, yeah, it's on the motherboard, but I added a couple other cards just to have more USB 3.
Yeah, I just get rid of the other cards and get USB 3 hubs.
Okay.
And then put them onto the USB 3 ports.
I was hoping by putting other cards in there, it would give me more bandwidth for some of the higher bandwidth things I have, like hard drives that plug into these. So that was the thought process, but now when I plug things into there, sometimes they'll stop working, and so I don't have a lot of faith in these cards. So like, I wouldn't plug a hard drive into those. I use them for like, you know, shuttle contour controller and stuff, and I plug hard drives right into the motherboard.
Yeah.
But all right.
Try getting rid of the cards.
Okay, cool. All right, next question. I want to find out if the apps, especially social media apps, on a Nokia Lumia Windows phone will work on a Surface Pro 3.
Honestly, I have no idea.
Until you tell us what app you're talking about.
Correct. So the Windows Phone apps, the latest ones, are being produced as universal-style apps. So it's not the identical app. Like, you can't just take the Zap package or whatever from the phone and then install it on the desktop, but it may be available for as a universal app through the phone store and through the desktop store, the modern store. Now, if it's a social app strictly for the Lumia phone, like there's certain apps that are only for Lumia,
yeah,
then they're not going to be available on the desktop at all. And as time goes on, there's going to be more and more universal applications, so you might have better luck checking again in the future. But honestly, without knowing which app that you're talking about, I have no idea. You know, there's the Facebook app that is on phone and on desktop, the Twitter app, you know. I'm not much into social networking, so beyond that, I don't know what else is out there.
Okay. All right, next question. Is it true that Windows 7 Home Premiere will only recognize up to 16 megabyte of RAM?
No.
They mean gigabyte?
Even gigs, no.
Yeah, all right. Well, either way, no.
Yeah, Win 7 Home Premium will get up to, I believe, at least 32 gig, if not 64, or higher. Honestly, without going and doing a basic search, figuring out what the minimum recs are.
Maybe they were thinking about the 32-bit thing with RAM.
So 32-bit OSs will only be able to address a general max of 4 gig.
Yeah.
But if you're 64-bit, and I've tend to just forget about 32-bit OSs, then no, there's no 16 meg limitation, you know. For goodness sake, that would be insane.
Okay. All right, next question. I have a small set of files on a USB drive that I brought with me while visiting family. While here, I've used both my brother's and my sister's computers. I've saved a few things on the USB drive when I first arrived, and everything worked as usual. When I switched to using another computer, all the files on the flash drive were inaccessible. It's like the permissions have been changed. I've tried making changes through sharing, changed the permissions for the top-level folder, and made sure that the subfiles and folders are included. Nothing seems to work, at least not completely.
Well, one, I would be worried about plugging your USB stick into various machines that you don't know their history of, because it's entirely possible that they're infected with something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me jumping to the worst case scenario.
Yeah. You tend to do that once in a while.
I tend to. Really, the simplest thing to do is, let's see if I'm able to, I can at least get you through the general aspects. So if you go to your properties of the drive, go to security, go to advanced, go to owner, change the owner, add yourself or add the administrator group, give yourself owner permissions, and then after you've done that, then go back and then add the administrator group or the users group, whatever you would like. So you have to click edit, add that particular group, add full control, and that will get you back all of your access. Now, the other thing to note is that this means absolutely nothing if your flash drive was formatted as FAT32.
Yeah.
Because FAT32, there is no permissions. And if there's something that's making it inaccessible, then it's not that.
Yeah.
So I would be interested to know if it's formatted as NTFS, in which case changing these permissions should actually work for you. But if it's FAT32 and you still can't access it, then I'd be worried that your drive is corrupted in some way, shape, or form.
Okay. Next question from David. We're having some issues where a user's library is using both their My Documents folder as well as a Public Documents folder. Is there a way to remove this access, or at least remove the public documents from the libraries, as a large amount of users have started saving locally and losing work?
Yep. So just load up Explorer, show libraries, go here, choose documents, right click properties, and you can see that this is what I've got as set up as my my documents library.
Mm-hmm.
And in there is going to be the public folder. Just go ahead and remove it.
Yep. Cool. All right, next question. Explain disk thrashing, and what is the difference between disk thrashing and disk I/O? What would be symptoms for average PC knowledge user's perspective of disk thrashing, and how can I figure out using tools and other disk performance parameters? How can I reduce disk thrashing, and what should be optimal values of those disk performance parameters by exceeding it could cause disk thrashing issues?
Say that three times fast.
I can't.
Disk.
I can barely say it once.
Right, disk thrashing. Okay, first off, you're running platter drives.
Yeah.
Really the thing for disk thrashing and disk IO, basically the same thing. It's accessing your drive.
Yeah.
It's swapping to drive. It's having to load stuff from the disk that could stay in RAM.
So the function is the same, but the principle behind it are a little bit different. I mean, disk IO is thought of as a normal thing. Disk thrashing is something that could be a problem.
Well, it's only a problem if you're trying to, you're under memory pressure.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're on a very low memory system, a 1 gig system, for example, and you're running Photoshop, mm-hmm. Photoshop uses the disk as a swap location for these large image files. You're going to be doing a lot of thrashing and a lot of disk IO in order to pull stuff off disk, load it into RAM so that you can manipulate it and then save it back.
Mm-hmm.
So any time where you're having to swap and access virtual memory, you're going to have problems. The best way to get out of that is you have more RAM.
Yeah.
More things can stay resident in RAM, and you don't have to go swapping out to disk as often. Depending on the performance characteristics of the application that you're using. I mean, it could be just a bad app.
Yeah.
It's not optimized very well. And is continually either accessing or flushing to disk. You know, that's another way of causing thrashing, is by flushing memory to disk constantly, mm-hmm. instead of letting the memory manager do it. Some applications do this for reliability reasons.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, it's not all that useful to continually flush versus letting the memory manager handle it. So if you want to avoid disk thrashing, you get more RAM. You get as mm-hmm. much RAM as you possibly can. If you're 32-bit system, you're not going to get any value out of anything more than 4 gig. Move to 64-bit, get more RAM, change your usage pattern. Obviously, get off of a platter drive, go to an SSD.
Yeah.
So all of these things will help reduce the overall throughput of trying to read the disk, and that's really what you're trying to prevent.
Yeah. And this is a good lead-in to our pick of the week. And our first pick of the week is a post from Hanselman, and it's the real incomplete story. This is the real story, and it is fairly complete.
This is straight from the storage team.
Does Windows defragment your SSD?
And the answer to that is yes, sort of.
But to be complete, you have to add the caveat of sort of. So it's a fairly long read, and you can just kind of cover it in a nutshell here. But if you ever wondered, you know, what's going on with SSDs and Windows, this is it.
Well, I think basically the misconception has always been, if I have an SSD, I don't have a read head.
Yeah.
Why would I worry about defragmentation?
It's random access. It's jumping to where it needs anyway, so why would you have everything?
Well, because an SSD is still a collection of memory cells
mm-hmm.
that is physically located, you know, in a space.
Yeah.
And there is overhead in reading and writing and deleting and being able to consolidate areas of that drive together
mm-hmm.
so that it is more efficient. And really, this is all about efficiency.
Yeah.
You can go and read through the article. It goes into the gory details of why folks that have a very particular idea of what SSDs are and what platter drives are, they go into quite a lot of detail as to it's actually not what you think it is.
Yeah.
You know, reading and writing to an SSD is in a lot of ways very similar to a platter drive.
Mm-hmm.
All of the same nuances, or most of the same nuances, still apply.
So the other thing too is I think a lot of people they want to make sure that they're not doing too many writes to their SSD because there's a limited amount of writes before the SSD goes bad, which seems counterintuitive to me. It seems to me that a platter drive would have a shorter life than an SSD. But my understanding is that after some number of writes, an SSD becomes slower or has a higher failure rate. What exactly is going on there?
So as with anything, things wear out.
Yeah.
Right? And SSDs can wear out. Physical drives, physical platter drives can wear out. And that's really what we're talking about here. But what you have to really be aware of is the SSD is intelligent, mm-hmm. right? It has its own firmware. It knows what it has to do to stay healthy. And the OS is interacting with it. It has
information. Yeah, and Windows detects when it's an SSD, and it won't do a bunch of writes like it would with a platter drive, right? It does some things
There is a different defragmentation mechanism for SSDs as there is for platter drives.
Yeah. So this is a good read here. We'll link to this, and I would suggest at least a glance at this because it's really good information. It's an interesting read. And then the second pick of the week, we couldn't wait for April Fools. Had to talk about this now. It's a post off Reddit of Excel pranks and tricks posted to the Excel subreddit. And so this is just a bunch of goofy stuff that you can do to yank people's chains and cause all kinds of havoc. And there's stuff like, what was that first one? When you type 100 into a cell, some speech is played. And so, yeah, it's...
I'm now self-aware, thank you.
Yeah, so all these different ones that you can try, you can drive your friends and family insane with all these different little scripts. So wanted to put this out there so you can get started early for your April Fool's pranks.
It is funny though, because if you try to use any of these in Excel by default won't run scripts. So you actually have to allow scripts to run. So ideally you'd want to you wouldn't want to just send an Excel sheet with just this. You'd want to have to hide it with another Excel sheet that does something else that's useful.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so that is the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defrag@microsoft.com or defragshow@microsoft.com. We'll get either one. And we will see you next week.
Take care.